From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They say you can't put a good man down. That seems to be true for Steve Jobs, the driving force behind Apple computers, and the first man to wear that trademark black T-shirt and a white iPod in public. A few years ago, analysts called Steve Jobs and Apple a spent force doomed to a niche market of cult consumers. Today, their little white products are everywhere. Apple stores are the busiest boutiques in trendy malls around the country. Why? Because Apple has set its sights on one goal, to actually do what AOL, Time Warner, Microsoft, and others never quite delivered, to bring the mountain to Muhammad, to make computers, the internet, and media conform to how people live, think, and play instead of to wires and software manuals. Now Apple has Hollywood churning. They've got a deal with Disney and a nifty new product that will put their TV shows and movies in your pocket, ready or not. This hour on Point, Apple and the endless media revolution. Listeners, viewers, podcastees, you can join the conversation. Does it look like a cultural revolution to you beyond the technology? Or is the video iPod just the latest Cabbage Patch craze? And in a week when American automakers are struggling, can earbuds and iPods pick up the slack for the U.S. economy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from San Francisco is Leander Caney. He's an editor and writer at Wired News, author of the just-released book Cult of iPod. His earlier book was Cult of iMac. Leander Caney, thanks for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So here we are, outsiders looking in, except nobody is entirely an outsider, the way Apple is moving out into the world. Take us into the sort of heart of the buzz and excitement about this product release. I mean, after all, it's just a 2.5-inch screen with moving pictures on it. What's behind the hubbub?
Because people have been looking for these devices for a number of years, and Apple is not the first. A number of companies have released small video players, and people are hoping that Apple will bring their genius for ease of use to this category and create a new way to sell TV shows and movies.
Let's look at the product for a minute. It's, more or less the same dimensions as an ordinary iPod? I mean, I realize those have a range of dimensions.
It's even slimmer than the current range of iPods.
And how much video can it hold?
Hours and hours. The big one can hold 150 hours worth of video, and the smaller one, the 30-gigabyte iPod, can hold, I think, 15 hours of video.
And what's the plan here? We see what Apple has done with iPod. You got your iTunes music store and people downloading all over the place at 99 cents or whatever the current price is. Is that the vision, that we will download movies, television shows, original for video iPod viewing? Is that the idea, and pay per piece, per time?
Oh, yeah, they hope so. I think, they can see a huge market for TV shows, movies, video podcasts, homemade content. I think they're hoping that it will create a whole new category of maybe short-form movies, short-form documentaries. People will make video content specifically for the iPod, for people on the go, just as they're starting to do now for mobile phones. I mean, you can get special ads that are made, little amusing, quirky ads that they're hoping people watch when they're sitting on the subway or on the bus on the way to work.
We're trying to figure out what's nifty, what's revolutionary here. Listeners, you can join us with your view at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. Leander Caney is with us from Wired News in San Francisco. We're joined as well right now from New York by Doug Rushkoff. He's author of the forthcoming book, Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out. He's professor of new media at New York University. Doug Rushkoff, thanks for being with us.
Hi, good to be with you.
Help us wrestle with this question here. Steve Jobs knows how to play the media like a harp, and he has beautiful products, and they're selling a ton of them. But behind the sort of marketing sizzle, what's going on with these little tiny boxes that fit in our pockets that Apple's pushing? Where's this taking media, the quote-unquote revolution?
Well, essentially, I mean, I guess you have to know whether he's taking the media there or whether he's kind of following the culture there. But I definitely believe that there's been a big shift in the way people relate to their media, that we used to relate to it completely as, you know, as viewers or as readers, and now at least many of us relate to it more as authors or as media makers. And what Steve Jobs has been really good at is creating product for people, you know, on all ends of the spectrum, at all levels of development, you know, so that, you know, he'll make an iTunes, say, is for someone who just listens to music, a pure music consumer. Someone who's slightly more advanced and now thinks of themselves not just as a consumer, but as someone who's like an expert consumer, you know, now can share their iTunes libraries with other people. So then they're sort of acting as a DJ, as sort of a surrogate consumer for other people. And then someone else who's even more advanced might, you know, use GarageBand, another good standard Apple Macintosh program
to make their own music.
Actually make their own music.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone who's even more advanced, you know, will go into the code of a Macintosh, which is now kind of a simple Unix type system, and write new software for other people. So the beauty of the Macintosh system right now and his wide array of products is that it appeals to people all along who want to begin sharing or creating rather than just consuming.
So all those years ago, the famous Apple ad with a sledgehammer is thrown into the giant Orwellian television screen, the kind of liberation of everybody to race onto the media landscape. Leander Caney, is this it?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Well, you remember the famous Apple ad for TV where the runner comes into the auditorium and throws the sledgehammer through the giant TV screen, the Orwellian image up there.
Indeed, yeah, it could well be. People, as Douglas says, are creating their own media more and more, and they have an outlet on the internet and now with the iPod and the video iPod, which never existed before. And people also, they don't want their media served up to them in the old ways. They want to go hunt for it. They want it on their own time. They don't want to watch a primetime show when the network decides to broadcast it. They want to TiVo it and watch it when it's convenient for them.
What does this mean? What does it mean, Leander, for big media? I mean, right now, Apple's still out there looking to cut deals with. They already have with Disney. I'm sure they'd like to do it with all of Hollywood and television land. It doesn't look as though that's been brought to its knees just yet here.
No, it's early days yet, but people are already speculating that Madison Avenue is really scared about this because it makes the primetime schedule a lot less valuable as advertising real estate. And so they're wondering, you know, how are they going to get these ads in front of people if they're going to go to the iTunes store and buy them for $2 a pop and they're ad-free when they watch them on their iPods.
That's the TV show that you watch on your iPod, and so Apple off to the races and changing the landscape. We're exploring exactly how it's changing. Leander Caney is with us. Doug Rushkoff is here. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and our listeners want to get in on this. Maggie's calling from Orleans, Massachusetts. Hi, Maggie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Well, great. What do you think?
Well, based on your opening, I'd like to throw out a hypothesis, and I'll take my response off the air, but I do believe it's a cultural thing. As a baby boomer, we have sort of dominated by our size alone. Our society is pretty much geared to the baby boomer. And now as we start to pass on to the next divide, younger generations are getting their say, and they're showing us different things.
How different does it look to you, Maggie?
Oh, it's looking at the world in a whole different way. It's exciting in that they're throwing out things that make you want to think about, well, how do I want to live my life? There's no one way to live it. And your iPod, of which I have one, is just you can listen to music when you want to. You can listen to broadcasts of WBUR if you want to. And then this whole new thing about videos, while the size for us baby boomers is a little small.
2.5 inches. Where are my reading glasses?
Yeah. There's just so many options available. The technology of the world, as I said when I was waiting,
yeah.
This is like the automobile was to our grandparents. It's who knows where it's going to go, and it's so exciting.
We're going to talk more about that later in the hour, but let me just get a gut check with you, Maggie. That may be true in cultural terms. See the USA in your Chevrolet, whatever the iPod version of that will be. Do you think it can ever be that in economic terms? Can we look to this as salvation, as GM struggles along, Delphi this week, cutting wages, all the rest?
Well, salvation, that's a whole nother hour-long discussion.
Or a few.
This is a change, and change is difficult, and you don't know what's on the other side. I'm sure there's a lot of similarities to what happened with the car versus the horse and buggy, and people were talking about it in a bad way, but change is inevitable, change is good, and I look at it, it's how I'm going to stay young.
Wow, plug the earbuds into a boomer and you've got Maggie on fire here. It's great. Maggie, thank you very much for your call. We're coming up to a break here. Let me just turn to Doug Rushkoff with that. Are you on with that, Doug? Do you see a cultural change that's sort of new autonomy or anarchy, depending how you look at it, Maggie's celebrating?
You know, I would argue it's a change, really. I mean, this is what I do in most of my books now. I argue that it's a change as big as the Renaissance, you know, as big as, you know, the development of perspective and individuality that we got in the 1400s or 1500s kind of reached its peak in consumer culture and the cult of the individual. And now we're much more interested in writing and sharing different media properties with one another rather than just sitting alone in our home absorbing stuff. So I think it is a big change. And the iPod and the Macintosh, the way people play with their home media, is really just the tip of the iceberg, because it will change the way we understand economics, the way we understand commodities, the way we understand, you know, each other's nations. I think she's right. It's as big a change, you know, as the automobile, and hopefully more positive one.
Earbuds and an iPod, and off we go. It's a new renaissance. Doug Rushkoff in New York, Leander Caney in San Francisco. Please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about Apple, iPod video, and the endless media revolution churning through our economy and our culture. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Does it look like a revolution to you, like a new renaissance to you? 1-800-423-TALK. Have you got your earbuds in? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Apple, iPod video, and the endless media revolution getting all kinds of ink this week. We wonder what you think of it. Are we plugged into a fad or the future here? And what is that future? Is there a viable economy in it? And what culture do you see in there? Are you part of it already? Are you way out there? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Is this already your way of life settled on the new frontier? We've been joined in this hour from San Francisco by Leander Caney, editor and writer at Wired News, author of the new book Cult of iPod. Doug Rushkoff is with us from New York. His book is Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out. And right now from New York, we're joined by Lev Grossman, staff writer for Time Magazine, author of this week's cover story in Time on Steve Jobs and Apple. Lev Grossman, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Lev, you've spent a good deal of time with Steve Jobs lately as he crept up to this big announcement last week. What does the man himself think about what he's doing here, what he's prompting, pushing?
Well, you know, Steve is not a man for excessive modesty or understatement. So if you asked him, I think that he'd probably say that what he's doing is pretty important and will have wide-reaching consequences. He's very proud of two things. One, he's very proud of the way that people are rediscovering music that they perhaps haven't listened to for a while. They're finding new bands which they never would have encountered before, and that's actually certainly been the case for me personally. I have listened to a lot more music in the past 2 years than I did in all of the 1990s.
We become actors and explorers instead of just recipients of whatever radio shoves at us.
That's right. And that brings me to not my point, but Jobs' second point. He's very concerned about, he feels that when he was growing up, kids were growing up in a text-based environment, and everybody could read, but everybody could write as well. Now, he feels, we live in a culture that's dominated by video, by TVs and movies, and he's very concerned that young people learn to author in video. That is, they learn to make their own videos so they can talk back to the culture in the same language that it talks to them in. And he feels he's helping them do that partly through Apple's video software like iMovie, but also with the video capability on the new iPod. It lets them exchange videos and take them to places they never were before.
Now, why there's a little gap here in my mind between the earbuds in the street on the subway at the Starbucks and this creative paradise that Steve Jobs is thinking about. I guess you've got to follow his products upstream to iMovie or GarageBand to actually become that author.
That's exactly right. Steve, and this is speaking just for Steve and not the entire culture doesn't think of the iPod as a product within itself. He sees it as a small component in a larger system that he's creating, and that system consists of Apple hardware, Apple software like OS X, and as I mentioned, iMovie, which is actually quite a good piece of software for creating custom home video.
And this time, he's not up against the wall of Microsoft and Windows. Apple computers, only 4.5% of U.S. computers use Apple's operating software. But here, Apple has 74% of the digital music player market. I mean, he's got open running room here.
Oh, yes, that's absolutely right. Steve is the overdog this time, and he loves it. You cannot overstate how much of a professional and personal redemption this is for him. He feels like the PC market was not a fair market. It wasn't one in which consumers had enough choice. He now feels he's in a more sort of frictionless and fair market, and he's getting a fair shake for the first time in his career, and he's loving it.
And what about Hollywood, Burbank? Are they going to play with Steve Jobs, or are they dreading this? Are they afraid that this is going to be major leakage for their TV shows and movies?
I have only heard good things. They've watched the music business, and the iTunes music store hasn't exacerbated the piracy problem, and I think that they find that very encouraging. I'm impressed that Disney and ABC are licensing their content for him. And
But that's all so far, right? I mean, you've got Desperate Housewives and Lost, and That's So Raven, and some Pixar stuff coming up, but that's an awful lot of people still on the bench, on the sidelines.
That's true, but it's Jobs who's keeping them there. This is gamesmanship on his part. He's keeping access to his channel, the iTunes Music Store, as scarce commodity, so that people will be banging on his door to get in. Remember, he's also a content producer. He's the head of Pixar, and he's licensing Pixar content. So he's confident that this is going to work, and he's hoping, and I would tend to agree with him, that other studios, movie and TV, will be very excited to get their content into his channel.
All this vision of a future through a 2.5-inch screen, and we wonder how it's sounding to you, listeners. Does it add up? Does it make sense? Are you already through the looking glass here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Frank's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
I'm reasonably well. How about you?
We're very well indeed. What do you think?
Well, it occurred to me that we're living in a time of increasing polarization. And a lot of the underlying social structures that support things like the businesses that can run the Internet and the international agreements that allow for naming on the Internet and all that sort of thing are at some risk. And when you talk about things that generate micro-cultures that allow people to hook up together, but only in very distant kinds of ways, that you may actually be exacerbating that trend.
So, polarization on the one hand, then microcultures, and it looks like an extension of polarization to you. Let us pick it up. Frank, thanks for your call. Doug Rushkoff, do you see in the microcultures or individual cultures inside one head with two earbuds, Frank is kind of worried about it, says it may push people apart, or is it new things, threads coming together here?
Well, it's funny. I mean, half of the kind of fear-based questions I get are we going to divide into 1,000, a million microcultures?
Fragments.
Half of them are about, are we going to collide into one big corporate monoculture? You know, and I have a feeling both things happen. I mean, let's say everybody's using an iPod, but everybody's listening to different music, then they're sharing the media channel, but they're independent and unique in the content they're listening to. I think we're still we're wrestling with that, but I think in some ways we're wrestling it more in terms of our self-expression than we are in what we consume. I'm less concerned that people are going to be consuming very different things, but that everyone's going to be online with their own, video, blog, broadcasting their own private lives and nobody listening to anybody else.
We're all authors and no audience. Lev Grossman, how about Steve Jobs? Does he have a conscious political philosophy that he's pumping through this technology, or is there one implicit in the technology?
I asked him about this, and as my notes tell me that he dodged the question completely. I'm not
welcome
sure.
Welcome to 2005 USA.
I'm not sure he has a master theory exactly of the way his technology is affecting the culture. I would tend to agree that you know, there's sort of a complexity of trends that run in both directions. You have people connecting to music, which sort of meets their deep personal needs, and making connections that way, but also cutting themselves off to other connections. I often take my iPod on the subway, and there's something very strange and sort of pod people-like about the glazed eyes that one sees everywhere.
Everybody in their own world and their own buds.
Exactly.
Yeah, no kidding. Freddie's calling from Nashville. Hi, Freddie. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm an iPod owner, and I love it, but I'm not really an avid iTunes store shopper.
So what do you do with it? Do you hammer nails into the, I don't know, back steps?
No, I've ripped a bunch of my CDs, so I listen to kind of my pre-existing music collection.
Yeah.
And so as I'm on the one hand, I'm kind of concerned about format, because most of the things that are being distributed right now are use a form of lossy compression, but I'm easily as interested in distribution method. We've seen the iTunes Store, which kind of follows this build-your-own library of content, mm-hmm. you know, maintain your own personal library, but there are also some competing services like Rhapsody mm-hmm. that are more subscription-based, and you get access to a centralized repository of content, and it's more about paying on a recurring basis for regular access to that. And I'm kind of curious to know what today's guests think one of those content distribution models is going to win out over the other, or where this is all going to end up.
It's a great question. Let me put it to the panel. Leander, are you plugged into that? What do you think we're headed with distribution here?
I think people want to own their content. People want to buy songs. They don't want to rent it on a monthly basis. The problem with the subscription services is that you can have all you can eat as long as you keep paying your monthly subscription. As soon as you stop paying it, it all goes away.
And just to be clear on that, is it $9.95 now? I haven't seen the latest, but that you pay a set amount each month, and for that you have then access to everything that they've got on their servers for you. But if you're not a subscriber, it all goes away.
Yeah, and all the money, you could be paying money to build a library all this time. And of course, when you're a subscriber to these services, you get access to a huge amount of material. But I think this is only good for people who are constantly hungry, constantly looking, exploring, looking for new music. And I think most consumers want to build libraries. They're much more organic about what they listen to, and they want to keep songs and build a relationship with them and hold on to them after they for a longer time. The problem with the subscription services is that you're just renting it. You're not owning it.
Right, you don't own it. Doug Rushkoff, where do you see the dollars going here over time?
It's interesting. I kind of have been seeing things kind of trending the other way, that the younger people are, the less obsessed they are, as I might be, with, like, libraries and ownership. I mean, I keep all the books
I've ever read
on shelves, and I want my MP3s and my music files, and I want to keep them on discs and drives. But I think in some sense younger people are smarter in that the person who's left actually having to maintain the data mm-hmm. is the loser. You know, if you're maintaining the data, then it's a pain. It really is.
Maybe they know they can just float in this sea of content. They have the confidence that it will be there. It's all they've ever known.
Exactly. And it is just data. And if they do really have the sense of sharing space in this sort of data stream, then I don't think they're going to have the same compulsion to own their bits that we baby boomers do.
But how deep, how new, how strange or increasingly familiar this sea? George is calling from Harlem, Georgia. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you, my friend. What do you think?
Just before this program, I was listening to a cassette tape. You remember those, don't you?
You troglodyte, George. You ancient heathen. Was it still working for you, George? Were you boogieing?
It actually works. No, it was, unfortunately, it was a group of sociologists interested in technology.
Oh, okay. Okay, we'll all sit down then. Okay.
And one of the themes was that this proliferation of entertainment and information through what the technologies you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
rather than being a renaissance, is dampening and restricting individual imagination and especially reflection from which creation comes, because professionally engineered imagineering and information and music and entertainment is always available.
You're saying pull out the earbuds and listen to your own mind, think your own thoughts. Is that your concern, George?
Sure. And these people were talking about evidences in the society that point to that, and particularly in terms of young people and the lack of imagination and reflection that they are exhibiting. Now, I'm not the expert in that, but I'd be interested in what I would assume are people here are pro-technology, so am I, but is this a possible downside? And I'd like to just listen on the radio.
Great. George, thank you so much for your call. Lev Grossman, how about it? Glassy-eyed pod people just being fed from some, you know, universal central vessel, cut off from their own ingenuity? George is concerned about that.
I'll be honest, I actually share his concerns. I've been reading a new biography of the Beatles that's coming out in a couple of weeks by Bob Spitz, mm-hmm. and one of the refrains that they come back to is, here are these kids, they're living in Liverpool, there's no internet, there's barely any radio. Everybody in Liverpool at that time, they formed a band, and they wanted to play the music that they didn't have. They wanted to hear the music that was coming to them from nowhere, so they made it themselves. The hallmark of our current media environment is choice. It's colossal. You don't have to make the music. You don't have to make the music because that sort of your heart is longing for, because it already exists and you can find it. So, you know, I think that this sort of surfeit of choice and music, it has its downside. I would agree with George.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Doug Rushkoff, how about it? It kind of comes down to whether you see the individual as the core generator of creativity, or are we ready to shift over into this new shared mind, shared space, communal mind as a fount of creativity?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really advanced sentiment. I mean, guys like, you know, Neil Postman, a great educator and media theorist who recently passed away, was very concerned that people were sort of losing that time to sit in the study and contemplate, you know, or consider a work of fiction and, you know, sit there for a few hours. I mean, I don't know that it's the plethora of media that's preventing that as much as the marketplace. When you are constantly confronted with consumer choices, sometimes it feels like it doesn't leave time for much else.
But what about that notion of authorship that everyone was talking about earlier in this hour? I mean, that surely is more than just shuffling an iPod playlist.
Indeed. I mean, and the beauty of this sort of Apple sentiment, and I think there is an agenda under it. I don't think he would have called it the Apple if he wasn't thinking, let's put the power of creation itself in the hands of people and see what they do. At least when you get that Apple computer or that Apple device, there are options to get more involved. It's sort of like a good video game that after a kid has, you know, played through one way, he can then go online and find the cheat codes and play it another way, and then go online and find out how to program the game. So the idea is that these forms of media, because there are keyboards attached to them, because there is there are many avenues for the so-called consumer to put himself into it or to change it, that people will slowly start to take that initiative. The question is whether there's a bigger percentage of people that will do that than ever. You know, Lego was doing a toy called Mindstorms, which is basically like a programmable Lego, and it failed because it turned out only really about 15% of kids wanted to be able to program their own Legos. The other ones just wanted to buy sort of dinosaur kits.
And either way, it was all about the universe of Legos. Our caller George is saying, what about the universe in a single mind, in a grain of sand that's not plugged in to anything?
Well, yeah, but you could even say that about the alphabet, that, oh, all literature, it's still just plugged into, you know, those 26 letters. I mean, at a certain point, people or institutions are going to create conventions through which we're creative. I mean, it's just a question of whether the percent of so-called creative people is getting greater or getting smaller. More people are taking the initiative. And at the very least, people who have computers now have the tools for creativity that give them really almost equal standing with the people who are making the media that they're consuming.
There's a view, new conventions for communication in the palms of our hands, or millions of them anyway. Lev Grossman, Leander Caney, Doug Rushkoff, please stand by. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Apple, about iPod video, and the endless media revolution churning through our economy and our culture. Apple sure doesn't author all of it. There's a lot behind that, but they sure put a marketing face on it, and they make us all sit up and think. And right now they're pushing a lot. We're joined in this hour by Lev Grossman, staff writer for Time magazine. You may have seen his cover story on Steve Jobs and Apple this week. Joining us from New York, Leander Caney is with us from San Francisco, editor and writer at Wired News, author of Cult of iPod. Doug Ruschkoff is with us from New York. His new book is Get Back in the Box, Innovation from the Inside Out. He's a professor of new media at New York University. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jay is calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a comment and a question, and I'll take my response off the air as soon as I get done. My comment is that it goes to the question as to why the iPod is a success. And the answer that for that, in my mind, is that it appeals to multi-generations right now. Both my kids and my father have them, and for different reasons.
What does your father have it for, Jay?
He has it because he travels a bit from basically one domicile to another. He's got a couple of houses.
So is it music or books on tape or podcasting? What's he doing with
it? No, he uses it for carrying his music library with him.
Mm-hmm. What does your father like to listen to? I'm just curious, what's in his buds?
You know, that's a good question, and I really don't know the answer to that. He's had multiple friends, and including my kids, put together music lists for him.
Oh, that's awesome.
He's not what I would consider a music aficionado. He really just likes to have it in the background.
Right, but you're saying it spans generations and therefore popular?
Right, and he doesn't ever use the buds. He just plugs it into his stereo.
Okay, right. It's just another.
So my belief, and one of the reasons that the iPod is a success, is that it's a transport of media, and that the iPod video will be successful because of the reasons TiVo is successful, and that people will be able to grab content that they like and watch it where they want to.
When you want it, whatever you want, yep.
And so rather than simply watching it on your tiny screen when you're on the subway, my belief is you'll take it with you on vacation, plug it into the TV in the hotel, or plug it into the TV in the car, to which so many are equipped with, or you know, move it wherever you're going.
Right. And did you have a question with that, Jay?
Yeah, my question is that there was an earlier comment about how music is distributed, and I agree with a comment that people like to own their music, and so the model where you're buying a tune at a dollar a piece is what's going to be successful. But I am curious about your guests when it comes to video content, because I see people wanting to rent, you know, sort of rent videos, as we often do in reality, and that a subscription-based cable television iPod-type model where you're downloading, you know, current episodes of whatever the current hot...
Do people really want to own a library of Desperate Housewives or Lost?
They just want to watch it once, and that's it. And so that there may be two different distribution models, and that the it'll compel the advertisers to take a whole different approach to how they are providing funding for this and how Hollywood's actually spending its advertising budget.
Yeah, we've got it, Jay. Thanks for your question. Lev Grossman, do you have a view on that? Jay says, well, you might want to own your music. You might not, depending on your generation. But who wants to own, you know, a lot of old episodes of TV shows?
Well, I take Jay's point, definitely. I mean, it is a fundamental difference. Music is permanent, and video is disposable. The success of Netflix is I think, sufficient proof of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that alters the distribution model so very much. I mean, I think Jobs and everybody else is expecting people to throw away their episodes of Lost, or if they really like Lost a lot, they'll invest in a DVD when it's available. I mean, the video iPod is a low-end product in terms of for video and audio files. There's no question about that.
And the new TiVo that people are going to take and plug in and play it on their television, is that technically possible? I don't even know. Can you?
It sounds...
I'm sorry, Lev.
It sounds it's perfectly technically feasible, I think. I mean, TiVo has had all sorts of problems becoming a brand and sort of making its functionality appealing to the marketplace. But yeah, there's no question that portable, disposable digital video is the way in which video will exist in people's homes.
But let me ask all of you right now. I don't even know. Can you take something that you might watch on iPod video and play it through your, you know, 77-inch home TV screen? Doug, Leander, do you know?
You can, but
well,
it looks terrible.
The current stuff made for an iPod wouldn't look too good on your 70-inch screen, but that's just a matter of time and disk space.
So that's out there, though it might look a little thin right now. Let me get another call here. Bill's calling from Mount Vernon, Virginia. Hi, Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing? I've been listening to your discussions, and it's fascinating. What I think the technology and some of the creative power that's being placed in folks' hands has the potential to do is to advance how we can communicate asynchronously in time and space. Instead of using words, we can communicate ideas through music and what we now call video to express more complex ideas. And so in some ways, I think that if this catches fire and people start using this technology to create, it will actually provide a different level of communication for individuals.
Bill, expand on that. How will you communicate more complex ideas? Why would it be more effective than a great poem, or a sonnet, an opera, a great conversation?
Well, it's sort of been going on. I mean, I was born in the 60s, and, you know, you would turn your friends on with a tune or some music, and in some ways that would express things that a conversation just was not able to express. So I think in some ways, given the technological limitations of that time, this kind of communication was beginning to occur. A good question you might ask yourself is, when language was being developed, how many people just sat back and listened, and how many people formed sentences and communicated ideas? So I think we're just on the edge of a big ocean here, with potential to communicate in different ways. So I think that's kind of a positive.
Holy smokes, as big as that, which Neanderthals are going to use the language and which aren't? I guess when you put it that way, I want to get an iPod and start using it right away. Doug Rischkoff, is it as big as that? I mean,
well, it could be, or I mean, you know, you look at the development of written text. I mean, before we had the alphabet, we had this thing called hieroglyphs. You know, why were they called hieroglyphs? Because it was literally hiero-priestly glyphs, writing. So only the priests and the nobles were literate and were able to use this stuff and have what that caller rightly calls sort of asynchronous writing, being able to store a bunch of ideas in a single place and give them to someone else where they can then digest them. I mean, what we're seeing now in a best-case scenario is the tools for greatly enhanced literacy being put in many, many people's hands.
Video literacy, audio, music literacy.
Exactly. I mean, and people creating forms for one another that then can, you know, transcend many different boundaries. I mean, if a million people in Japan can see a two-minute video clip that my kid puts together, I mean, that's a form of cross-cultural communication that couldn't happen before.
Is it superior literacy, though? Is it better than an exquisite use of the language? A lot of what I see there
better,
is sort of shake.
Better is not... better is really hard to say. I mean, it's certainly true that just because, you know, South Park may be or because Shakespeare was the South Park of his age doesn't mean the South Park is the Shakespeare.
I don't know who's insulted or complimented there.
You know, exactly. I mean, everybody probably. But, you know, it's very hard to judge the ultimate quality of cultural output. But I think it's positive if more people feel that they have not only access to but reason to express something, even if it's by simply cut and pasting stuff from the media that's already out there. At least they're, you know, beginning to fire some creative neurons in their brains rather than just sitting and passively receiving things, and can lead to a different kind of a culture.
I'm listening. I'm trying to decide if this is a language I want fluency in. I also want to look at the economic impact of this. There's been a lot of news out of the old economy this week, the automotive industry, with big cuts and changes in contracts and wages and health benefits out of Detroit. Diane Brady joins us right now from New York. She's a senior writer for Business Week magazine. Diane, thanks for being with us.
Nice to represent the old economy.
We'll let you live on both sides of that fence, but I can imagine people listening to this in this week when we've seen such dramatic changes in a really troubled American automotive industry that got up kind of going a century ago, and people asking themselves, okay, here's a lot of buzz about earbuds and iPods and all the rest, but does it take the place in economic terms? Can we float this economy on what Steve Jobs and others like him are brewing? What do you think, Diane?
Well, you know, I think we're at an inflection point. Does it make up for billions lost at GM? At this point, I don't think it does, but it definitely signals to me a fundamental change in how we're going to compete as a country. There's no question you've seen GM, you've seen Ford, you've seen Delphi, which is the auto parts maker that was spun off from GM, posting miserable results. And what it says to me is that unskilled workers are not going to make it in this economy. They're not going to be getting the kinds of wages they used to have, and it's going to be innovative companies like Apple. I mean, the margins on those products are 45-50% versus GM that loses thousands of dollars for each car it sells.
Well, that margin may be true, but you're talking about a $200-$400 product instead of a $20,000-$30,000-$40,000 product, and many fewer hands making them, and I assume many of them not at all made in this country beyond the design work at all.
You know, I'm not quite as apocalyptic as some people who think everything is going to go overseas to India and China, but I do think we're seeing kind of a segmentation. It's almost like the Walmartization that people talk about. On the low end, there's a lot of suffering. I don't think that, you know, having a hot iPod is going to in any way correct that. But you're also seeing people kind of segment up. You're seeing a lot more cult brands these days, like Apple, IKEA, Harley-Davidson, Samsung, and you notice those aren't just American brands, but they're brands that have been able to create terrific customer experiences, and people are willing to pay a premium for them. So that's what's happening. I think that the middle ground is being lost, and really the companies that are going to make it are going to be these innovative players, and they'll be able to get the huge margins needed to succeed. But I don't think at this point it's going to make up for the really painful transition that we're going to have to go through as we watch further erosion of companies like GM.
Liv Grossman, I know it's a big picture, but do you see anywhere out there for the national economy, this creative economy, providing, you know, enough jobs for enough minds and sets of hands to offset the losses that appear to be that we're in the midst of, let's say, in Detroit?
I was at Apple a couple weeks ago, and an Apple executive who I'm sure would prefer to remain nameless said, Apple is becoming the American Sony, which I thought was an interesting sentence, and he certainly meant it quite literally. What I do think is very interesting is a shift that I see over the past 10 years from the importance of technological innovation to design. And the iPod was not a device that introduced new functionality. Mm-hmm. It did very little that other existing MP3 players, of which there were a whole ton, did. But what it did was it was very easy to use. It was beautifully designed.
But how many hands does that take? How many minds? A half dozen? 60? 600? Not 300 million?
That's true. But it does signal, I think, a shift in you know, what skill sets will be of ultimate value, you know, in the coming 10 or 20 years. It's not necessarily you know, engineering capability and manufacturing capability. It's this creative design sensibility that, you know, really becomes the center of value. And I think that's, you know, an area in which the United States, you know, could stand to gain.
Well, if that's going to be the arena of wealth creation, of economic activity, we'd better hope that, as people are saying today, that an awful lot of minds migrate to that world and become willing to pay for that design, is all I can say. But what a picture. I'm so grateful to all of you for being with us today. Lev Grossman at Time Magazine, terrific piece, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Doug Rushkoff, author of Get Back in the Box, great to have you today, Doug. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Leander Caney at Wired News, author of Cult of iPod. Leander, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Diane Brady, senior writer for Business Week magazine. Diane, we're hoping that it comes through for this economy big time somehow. Thank you for being with us.
I hope so, too. Thank you.
You can download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point. We've heard about Apple, GM, and Ford, and Delphi. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty has also been thinking about the news from Detroit and around the world.
In his New York Times column, Paul Krugman, author of foundational papers on free trade theory, asked, "Is globalization consistent with good wages?" and answered, "Maybe not." He cited Delphi, GM's parts division, forced into bankruptcy by low-wage foreign competition. It is seeking to cut employee wages from $27 to $10 an hour. GM itself, already squeezing the health benefits of its retired workers, and Ford, which just announced a major restructuring, soon may have to follow Delphi's lead on wages. Quote, "America's working middle class has been eroding for a generation," Krugman warns, "and it may be about to wash away completely," end quote. What occurred since 1970 to hasten that erosion? An historic departure. Its economy reared behind tariff walls, the U.S. adopted free trade. It began importing more goods, more and more of them from low-wage countries, than it sold abroad en route to today's historic trade deficit. In an inquiry into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations, Adam Smith, the Darwin of free trade, argued that, quote, "all commerce that is carried on betwixt any two countries must necessarily be advantageous to both." He illustrated the point with a quotidian example, quote, "it is the maxim of every prudent master of a family never to make at home what it'll cost him more to make than to buy. What is prudence in a family can scarce be folly in a great kingdom," end quote. Paul Krugman now joins the Nobel laureate Paul Samuelson in asking whether what is prudence in a family can be folly in a great nation.
Jack Beatty is On Point News analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Mary Moore, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette, Angel Cozzelli, and Manoli Weatherall at NPR today in New York. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.